Welcome to The Taxcast, the Tax Justice Network's monthly podcast with me, Naomi Fowler. Coming up, we've got a special focus on the results of the 2015 Financial Secrecy Index. And we've got no time for headlines this month. We're going to talk to John Christensen straight away for his take on the latest tax justice news and events. Okay, John, this month we're going to start off with the British Bankers Association, who've just released a very interesting report called Winning the Global Race, and the City of London is losing business, according to them, to the US, Hong Kong and Singapore. And they're citing all these pesky post-financial crisis regulations, and they're saying urgent action is needed.
Well, they should be worried, because what the financial crisis disclosed to the rest of the world is that actually the City of London, far from being incredibly competent, is largely incompetent, a very high-risk place. Worse still, they have very, very high fee rates. London lawyers and London bankers do not come cheap. Now, call me old-fashioned, but when I studied economics, I was told that if you want to compete, you compete by lowering your prices and being more productive and producing a better product. Well, that doesn't seem to be on the agenda of the British Bankers Association. The crisis and the post-crisis has disclosed how unfit for business they are. We haven't seen any improvement in the quality of lending to British or other businesses. They don't do their job properly. This is all part and parcel of the constant process of pushing for lesser regulation, lower capital adequacy requirements for the banks so they don't have to hold a ratio of equity assets to the total borrowings. They're constantly pushing back against the taxes, particularly the banking levy that was introduced after the financial crisis, so the banks would start contributing back to the taxpayers what they managed to extract from the taxpayers, the huge, you know, the hundreds of billions that were used in the banking bailout. I see this as back to business, back to the same old scammy activities that the British Bankers Association and the City of London Corporation have become notorious for. Of course, they're pushing up against a government that's only too happy to oblige, because we still have in the United Kingdom a government which thinks that banking is the only business in town. They talk the talk of trying to reinvigorate manufacturing activity, but the truth of the matter is that the British banking business simply isn't up to lending, developing productive activity. By and large, Britain is prone to what we call the finance curse. So the government is, I'm afraid, totally captive to the interests of the City of London Corporation, and will probably concede on everything they want, and they will probably want to get rid of the banking levy sometime within the next couple of years.
That's right, they do talk about specifically the banking levy, and these people were really at the heart of the global financial crisis as well. London was really the key, wasn't it?
Yes, I mean, if you look, for example, at some of the really major American collapses, you will find, case of AIG, for example, the insurance giant, that it was their London office that caused the calamitous failures which led to their bailout. And AIG wasn't alone in that. So the lack of regulation, the lack of scrutiny in London was very much part of the whole process of creating that environment within which a financial crisis was inevitable. And I fear that we're heading back that way.
Right. And speaking of the City of London, we have talked before on the Taxcast about how it does pose a global security threat, not just a national security threat. We should talk about an interesting development, which is a UK-China nuclear power deal, really connected very much to the City of London once again.
This is a story so bizarre. The UK is signing up to build not one but three new nuclear plants, but one of them, the plant at Hinkley Point in the West Country, is going to be the most expensive nuclear plant ever built, currently projected at £24 billion, that is. And to pay for this, the UK government has made the most extraordinary deal with the Chinese. A deal which, by the way, will last through to 2060. So we're talking about, 45 years down the line. It'll dwarf any of the previous private financial initiatives. The deal is that the Chinese will get a guaranteed price of £92.50 per megawatt hour coming out of this plant. That is twice the current market price. It's being guaranteed by the British government to secure this Chinese investment. And at the same time, the government is slashing its budget for renewable energies. What on earth is going on here? Well, at the same time as negotiating this very dodgy and frankly inexplicable, I mean, there's no way one can describe this deal with any kind of rational sense, the government is also pushing really hard for London to become the world's largest offshore trading centre for the Chinese currency, the renminbi. Currently, Hong Kong is the biggest offshore trading centre for the renminbi. London is now bidding to become a second one and eventually to overtake Hong Kong in that role. Huge sums of Chinese capital are sloshing around the world. No doubt Britain will desperately need some in years to come as its own trade deficits become more and more hard to finance. There are huge outflows of illicit capital coming out of China. No doubt the City of London will want part of that. The big question, as far as I'm concerned, is what possible benefit will this bring to the average person in Britain? What seems to be happening is bit by bit we're selling off all of Britain's infrastructure, all the long-term rent-seeking activities like, for example, nuclear power stations and this hugely subsidised electricity to the Chinese, and we have a government in Britain which is only too happy to take the short-term gains and pass on massive costs to future generations.
It could well be a bit of a sweetener because these are incredibly generous terms for the Chinese. They didn't have to partner with the Chinese. They could have partnered with Japanese companies, US companies, but they didn't. And, they went against the advice of security services. The US government was very concerned. All of that was ignored in order to put basically what is the Chinese military and communist ruling party at the heart of British infrastructure.
It's a puzzle what's driving it, and I can only imagine that what is driving it is this determination to put the City of London's interests ahead of all of UK's interests, including security interests.
Right, because there's all sorts of agreements going on at the moment, uniting their stock exchanges or linking them up. We have the People's Bank of China issuing short-term bonds denominated in Chinese currency for the first time ever outside China. In the City of London, all sorts of things going on there. So it's definitely one to watch and one that I'm sure that we'll look at again in the tax cast. Let's talk about 1 year after LuxLeaks, because it is 1 year since Antoine Deltour, the whistleblower, helped to reveal the way that, for example, Luxembourg's tax office was in sort of behind closed doors, granting all sorts of cosy deals with very large multinational companies, draining away tax revenues from their European allies and partners and neighbours. So a year on, you know, the European Union's been looking at what's gone on and what to do about it. You would hope that we'd have lots of cooperation now from European Union member states, but we don't, do we?
Well, at one level, things have moved on insofar as the Competition Commissioner has already come out with two rulings, one relating to Starbucks and the second one relating to Fiat. And in both cases, she has deemed that these advanced tax agreements struck between PricewaterhouseCoopers on behalf of its clients and the Luxembourg government were anti-European competition policy. In other words, they contravened the single market, causing harmful distortions, constituting illegal state aid. And I would be very surprised if the vast majority of the other agreements, and we're talking hundreds here, don't fall into exactly the same category. This is illegal state aid. Because these companies are getting these effective subsidies, it puts them at a market advantage over other companies, particularly small and medium enterprises, because they're not getting these advanced price agreements. The end result is less innovation, less job creation, and lower rates of growth. So this is harming Europe as a whole. And therefore, the European Commission should be giving this the highest priority. Are they hell? Now we know that the archival information, which would give a great deal more information about other countries and their advanced tax agreements, is being blocked by the United Kingdom, for example, and Luxembourg, and Netherlands, and Belgium. So we now have a battle going on between parliamentarians, the European Parliament pushing for better access, and the European Commission trying to block that.
Yes, and these documents are documents that had already been submitted by some of these national governments. And they were quite happy for a perhaps a small ineffective EU committee to have a look at them and to kind of sweep things under the carpet. But now there's a larger kind of body, I think, that's involved. And they seem to be getting a bit nervous and citing confidentiality clauses all over the place.
Yes, I think there's a matter of principle here that needs to be established. These government deals, these advanced tax agreements, should not be regarded as confidential. Multinational companies have no right and should not be able to negotiate dodgy deals with dodgy governments, which put them at a market advantage over other companies. This kind of state aid should be entirely on record. Of course they want to keep it secret because they know damn well that it's anti-market. It should all be accessible, not just to parliamentarians, but to the press. The public have a right to know about the deals being done by their governments on their behalf, because it's costing a great deal of money. This is the tax justice principle.
And there could be hundreds of these deals yet to come out into the light of day.
Thousands. PricewaterhouseCoopers is not the only company involved in doing these dodgy deals. The other big four accounting firms were doing exactly the same, and not just with Luxembourg. For example, I was economic advisor to the government of Jersey in the 1980s and the 1990s. I was negotiating these deals on behalf of companies setting up international business corporations in Jersey. And they were booking, in some cases, hundreds of millions of profits in Jersey with the negotiated tax rates as low as 0.5%. So it's not just Luxembourg, it's a variety of other tax havens across Europe. They've all been in on this, in some respects, a kind of corruption of the markets, which now needs to be exposed and brought into the public daylight.
Thanks, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. There was shock and surprise this month when the Tax Justice Network released its Financial Secrecy Index. Every couple of years, the Tax Justice Network uses 15 indicators to measure and rank countries based on a combination of their progress, or not, on tackling secrecy. They then combine that score with each country's size as a global contributor to offshore financial activity. Once again, the index reveals how the most important providers of financial secrecy aren't so much the small palm-fringed islands, but some of the world's biggest and wealthiest nations.
A couple of them very edgy. They're racing in the Golden Jubilee, and Black Caviar's got away to a good start. Society.
It really is a bit like a race between nations. But the question is, are they in a race to clean themselves up? Or are they galloping full speed ahead to get the world's dirty business before all the others do? I should say that the UK would easily take the number one spot if we included all its overseas territories and crown dependencies. Even without them added in, the UK's at number 15, which is bad enough. So that said, here are the world's top 10 worst jurisdictions in this year's index.
We are in front with 100 yards left to go. Here's Restia Darjeel and Moonlight Cloud. He eases up near the line. Here's Moonlight Cloud. It's tight.
Number one, yet again, it's Switzerland. Riding up just behind in second place, it's Hong Kong, that special administrative region of China. A big surprise in third place. It's the only country to actually increase its score since last time. It's the mega haven of the United States. Riding up behind in fourth place, it's Singapore. And Hong Kong was looking very anxiously over its shoulder in their direction at the finish line. Closely following in fifth place, it's the Cayman Islands, a UK overseas territory. And coming in at sixth place, it's Luxembourg. Seventh place, unchanged from last time when it was a surprise entrant into the top ten, it's Lebanon. Also unchanged at number eight, once again, we have Germany, a nation that's been working hard to block transparency initiatives. At number nine, it's the dictatorial constitutional monarchy of Bahrain, and coming in last at number 10 on this list of the worst contributors to global corruption, it's Dubai of the United Arab Emirates, a so-called twisted Switzerland of the Middle East.
The line, and this is tight. This is very, very tight indeed.
No need to stop there. There are 82 other countries in the final index, so go and check out your country's ranking on www.financialsecrecyindex.com. But let's take a closer look at some of these movers and shakers. Here's Clark Gascoigne of the Financial Accountability and Corporate Transparency Coalition talking to the Huffington Post about his country, the United States, and its dismal performance, as the nation the Tax Justice Network says is of most concern.
We surpassed the Cayman Islands and Singapore and Luxembourg since the last time this index was published. It's a number of reasons. The U.S. is actually one of the worst places when it comes to the incorporation of anonymous shell companies. It's easier to incorporate a shell company in the United States than it is to get a driver's license or even a library card in many states. And then on top of that, we're not really enforcing anti-money laundering laws in the United States very well. HSBC, for example, a couple years ago laundered hundreds of billions of dollars for Mexican drug cartels. They actually passed $200 trillion of money through their HSBC New York branch without applying the legally required anti-money laundering controls. And not a single person at HSBC was indicted or sent to prison.
And it's ironic that the United States has been very effective in defending its interests against foreign tax havens with laws like FATCA, the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, designed to track down hidden accounts of their own citizens overseas, especially in Switzerland. But they're not so hot on helping other countries find and tax their citizens' offshore stash in the United States.
We don't tax non-resident alien deposits in the United States. So if you're a foreign citizen and you put money in the United States, you're not going to be taxed on that in the US. So there's a lot of reasons to open up companies here. And actually, the World Bank did a study a few years ago and found that when you're a corrupt dictator or kleptocrat in a foreign country, the United States is actually the number one destination where you're going to open an anonymous company offshore. A couple of academics from Brigham Young University, UT Austin, did a study recently and found that the U.S. is the second easiest country in the world after Kenya. If you're a terrorist or corrupt official or criminal looking to launder your money, to open an anonymous company to do so. We're very bad at sharing tax information with foreign countries on foreign residents who have deposits in the U.S. The world has moved towards the exchange of information on an automatic basis. 100 countries have signed up to this, and the U.S. is still sort of trying to collect information on our own tax evaders without reciprocating, and the world is not going to cooperate with us unless we're playing ball.
Nearly 2 million corporations and limited liability companies are formed in US states each year, many by foreigners, without the real owners ever being asked to prove their identity. US legislation on greater transparency has been fiercely opposed, as you can imagine, by states like Delaware, Nevada, and Wyoming. The Tax Justice Network's Marcus Meinzer coordinates the Financial Secrecy Index research.
It's really of great hypocrisy how the United States have managed to lash out at a tax havens worldwide. And to be honest and to be fair, we owe the United States a lot in that respect. It has proven great leadership in that regard. In some way, it has managed to break open the Swiss banking secrecy, which would have probably not come about without the United States. But now to stop short of really playing ball, the United States itself is not acceptable. The current political situation and climate in the US is so hostile to moving anywhere nearer full-fledged membership of the international community and is geared towards US first, US interests alone and above everyone else's. And I believe this is the high time now for European Union to start taking serious action to bring the US back to the negotiating table and to, for instance, introduce a 35% withholding penalty tax for anyone that is investing in the European markets, in the financial markets, but is not willing to fully reciprocate that data. This is only fair and proportional since the United States do exactly the same. They have in their FATCA law this kind of penalty withholding tax. If the European Union want the US really not to become the mega tax haven of the 21st century, then we should be very clear about this requirement. And this is the only language, I'm afraid, the United States at the moment is willing to understand. The economic power European Union yield in that respect can be used to bring the United States back to this sensible reciprocal agreements.
Right, and it hasn't got behind country-by-country reporting either for corporations to publicly share how much tax they're actually paying in each country they operate, something they would themselves benefit from, since an estimated $150 billion a year is lost to the US Treasury that way. Let's talk about Germany now, Marcus, because they're a big surprise too. Number 8 on the Financial Secrecy Index. It's actually one of the world's biggest secrecy jurisdictions, a safe haven for dictators' loot, assets of organised crime, proceeds of tax crime and other illicit financial flows from around the globe. It's not really the impression that most of the world has ever had about Germany, is it?
Germany has managed to fly under the radar, but undeservedly. Really, with data on of the German Bundesbank, the German central bank, I'm showing in a recent book that Germany's assets in the financial system that bear tax-free interest held by non-residents amounts to 3.1 trillion euros. This is a tremendous amount of money that is stashed in Germany. If it was subject to German withholding tax, as domestic residents would need to pay, the tax loss amounts to 21 to 24 billion euros a year. And only 1% of that money is also reported back currently under the European Information Exchange System to the tax administrations of the home countries of those investors. What is more, and what is really outrageous in my view, is that tax evasion, if committed abroad in Germany, does not count as a predicate offense for money laundering. So if I come to a German banker and I want to stash €1 million, and I tell the banker, this is money that I evaded tax on and I want to continue evading tax on, and I come from South Africa, from Argentina, or from Thailand, the German banker can accept that money without being at risk of being prosecuted at all. He's not committing any crime by taking this money. A banker can even accept in Germany money if it comes from embezzlement, blackmailing a dictator, someone looting their country. This is outrageous, and I think few people understand it. And this has led to a great hole in the European and OECD efforts in countering these kind of illicit of stolen monies worldwide. Switzerland, Luxembourg, Great Britain and the US are far better and have confiscated and repatriated sums of foreign dictators who stole unashamedly money from their populations. Not so Germany. Germany has not frozen any single cent between 2006 and 2012 of such looted money from abroad. And this has to change.
And Germany's been very active as well, haven't they, in trying to block moves towards public registers of beneficial owners, that's the real owners of companies, an agreement which some European partners are trying to get together.
That's right. Germany was at the forefront of leading the opposition to that. And we have this problem that Germany plays in Europe a very devastating role. It is playing a similar role as the United States is playing internationally, the role of a spoiler, playing delaying tactics. And we observe that, most importantly, in a current very important initiative, a new directive is on the way at the European Union level, the Shareholder Rights Directive. It's in early stages. It is just entered the tripartite negotiation at the European Union level. But Germany has already positioned itself against the requirement that is currently part of this directive for companies of all sectors to publicly disclose reporting financial data on a country-by-country reporting basis. So we have the risk here of Germany really spoiling again the party and stopping the modest leadership role the European Union has been managing to take in the last 2-4 years, with some transparency reforms being really pushed from Europe and hopefully rippling out throughout the world.
Okay, and this time as last time, Switzerland is in the number one ranking in the Financial Secrecy Index. The Swiss Banking Association, they're not really pleased about this category of number one spot.
Yes, we see the Swiss market share in the global cross-border offshore financial services is growing, has been growing from 2011 to 2013, which is the data that we use. So the Swiss do have indeed a lot of homework to do for improving their record in secrecy terms. The argument that Swiss would be now clean and tidying up their act may be truer for some countries, but for the vast majority of the planet's population, this is not true. Switzerland applies what we call a zebra strategy. So there's white money for the powerful and influential countries, while there's a deliberate strategy in attracting, in making good the loss of dirty money from emerging economies and developing countries. The clear strategy to grow in those markets is visible, for instance, in the annual return of Swiss banking giants of the year 2013 and 14. There we see it even spelled out in their annual accounts, in their private wealth management, that this is where they aim for increase of assets under management. And the source of that increase is to be coming from those emerging economies, the three southern continents, Africa, Asia and Latin America.
Right, and you can really see that in the way they've reluctantly sort of signed up to mechanisms for multilateral exchange of information. They're first demanding reciprocity from other countries, so they'll get information on accounts and companies coming back to them about their own Swiss citizens too. And I mean, that makes sense for exchange of information between OECD nations, for example. But the Swiss are insisting on that from poorer countries too. But it's really not likely, is it, that Swiss citizens are stashing money in Nigeria or in Honduras? So, I mean, why would they insist, Marcus, on something that those nations will have genuine practical difficulty with implementing? I mean, unless they're protecting their own banking sector's interests in emerging economies, right?
That's right. The general standard of the OECD on automatic information exchange does allow this kind of hypocrisy to persist, in that only when a country is reciprocating fully will it be eligible for actually receiving data under the multilateral platform, at least. And this is where the developing countries are the ones who lose out, and will, for a foreseeable future, many countries will have considerable trouble in getting the systems in place, getting the complicated rules. These are hundreds and hundreds of international legal speak that this standard consists of. And now imagine this should be translated into the domestic legal framework for the sake of nothing, because really in Nigeria there's no Swiss resident or German resident or US resident hiding its money in Nigeria. So I think the most important fundamental point with Switzerland is that the Swiss have announced that they are not going to enter into a treaty exchange with developing countries. They haven't said it like that, but they have announced that they will prioritize countries of important economic and financial ties, and they have already announced that they are going to be able to move only very slowly in expanding the network. And this is hypocritical to argue that way. We have, in the Swiss case, the country with the highest technological capability base across the world, probably the people and the capacity and the technical expertise to make this happen, really to do this in one stroke, in one go, instead of salami tactics here being applied by the Swiss government.
And there are two particular areas the Tax Justice Network's been warning about for a long time in terms of the direction of travel for bankers, lawyers, accountancy firms and other enablers who would quite like to continue business as usual and dodge the movement towards transparency. Free ports are a growing area, kind of warehouses for storing physical assets. We'll be looking at free ports very soon on the TaxCast. And all eyes are on the trust sector. Apparently no serious actions been taken about them, despite G20 promises. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network.
The reason this causes such concern is because trusts as agreements are not registered anywhere. There's no information about the fact that they exist. So they become the basic building block around which you build any offshore secrecy structure. The trust will own a company or a series of companies which own assets. And of course, once the assets are owned by these companies which ultimately belong to the trust, there's no way of knowing who actually benefits from this, and there's no way of discovering any information at all about the trust. And the British government has worked very, very hard to try to block attempts to include trusts in automatic information exchange processes. And there's an organisation, the Society for Trust and Estate Practitioners, a legal lobby, who work very hard offshore to ensure that trusts are excluded from this. So you have a very powerful lobby backed by the British government itself.
If you want to really hide your ownership and your identity, there's plenty of opportunity for you to do so.
You're absolutely right. And I imagine that lawyers around all of the tax havens will be saying to their clients, don't worry about information exchange processes, because all we'll do is we'll set up your affairs under the control of a trust which will own your assets, and then you can quite legitimately say nothing to do with me, mate, because it's a trust that owns and controls the assets on your behalf or on behalf of your family. So, yes, happy days.
You've been listening to The Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. We'll be back next month.